You're listening to Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Episode 12. Ready, steady, GoPro. Yeah, so what did you do last week?
Oh, I always forget this part.
So, drunk and hungover mostly, really?
I worked a lot and...
Yeah, you were recording a bunch of stuff and... I don't know about and editing it.
Yeah. I don't know. Last week is really kind of a blur.
Something about a puppet show, I remember.
Oh, well, yeah. The puppet show was not long ago. The department, the second-year grad students do a puppet show every year where they kind of roast the faculty.
Harvard education, folks.
Yep. Yeah. It's a time-honored tradition.
They've often had roasts and such and had some sort of Follies-type program where, you know, they'd get really, really huge stars in it. They'd get, you know, Glenn Close to do it, and
that's more of the Harvard as a whole. This is just a bunch of physics grad students making puppets and making fun of people.
That happens too.
You know. It's fun.
Nice.
What about you? What did you do?
I worked a lot. We're actually in the middle of doing this gigantic branding exercise. Part of doing that is doing a lot of competitive analysis, a lot of research, and a lot of it's quite exciting, which is nice, but it's also very tedious, writing everything down, trying to distill it, presenting it. Very excited about that, and also very scared because June seems like it's far away, but it's going to creep up instantaneously.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, got a lot of work to do, and probably a lot of sleepless nights. I've been going to bed routinely at about 3 o'clock in the morning and getting up at 6:30.
Oh, as opposed to going to bed at 2 a.m. and getting up at 6.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that hour and a half is all the difference, I have to say. It really is. Well, one of the other things that happened was the Canon 5D Mark III was finally announced after...
Yeah, I'm sure that led to a sleepless night.
Yeah, because they announced it at something like midnight or 1 a.m. Eastern time, because it was, right, you know, done in Japan. There were a few sites that were trying to live blog it, and they just burned in flames. It was totally impossible. And then about 20 minutes after the thing was supposed to start, the official website, Canon's official website, went up. And so I was able to just grab all the specs from it and said, all right, that's kind of cool. And wound up pre-ordering it from B&H. So I figured, you know, if it's a horrible disaster, I can always cancel my order. Chances are fairly good it won't be, and hopefully I'll be one of the first few to get one, because I am going to the Oregon Brewers Festival in the last week in July, and it would be really nice to have had the camera for a while to understand it quite a bit.
Well, for all intents and purposes, it looks like it's going to be an amazing piece of kit.
There have been a lot of cameras that have entered the field that are really quite extraordinary in what they can do for the amount of money that you have to shell out, you know, and that's really exciting.
Yeah, it's a bit of a renaissance, I think, for the indie or doco shooters right now. The cameras that have just come out, especially the C300, FS100, which we're going to talk about, I think.
And of course, the whole gonzo videographer GoPros as well, which they're just so damn cool, I have to say. I mean, they're tiny, you can put them anywhere, and they're cheap as chips too. The brand new ones, the most expensive ones, are $300.
Right. That's the camera. There's no naked option this time, which is their version of, you know, just body. It's like, it's $300. That's a camera. That's the entire kit with, right, you know, the case and the, you know, the,
it's got a housing. It's got a housing. It's got a battery. It's got mounting options, and it also comes in multiple flavors as well. So you've got the, I'm the outdoors person, or I'm the waterproof person where I'm going to be using it in the water, and it's just really, it's absolutely amazing. It's a great bang for the buck. And the new versions, the new cameras, the Hero 2s, are just, they're stunning. The quality that comes out of those is really, really nice.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited by them and, you know, what's to come, but I think I'm going to go ahead and order the motor sport kit, because that's the most versatile one since I'm not like a sports person. Right. I'm totally on board.
For the general purpose, because I mean, so the what makes the sports thing is that it comes with all these like cool suction cups things that you can attach to your vehicle, which is just really, really cool. And I mean, think about it, you know, you can have, for less than $1,000, you can get three of those kits, and have full coverage in your vehicle. You know, you can get a low shot by the front wheel, so you can get a nice sense of speed. You can get a through the windshield driver, and you can get a tail as well if you want. And that's perfect. I mean, that's really all the coverage you'd want.
Yeah, and but they're so small. If you wanted to, you could put them almost literally anywhere. If you're doing like a motorsport show, you know, I mean, you can hide these things in crevices practically.
Yeah, you could do interior cockpit as well. And because they stick to pretty much anything and they are indestructible, you know, they don't, it doesn't matter if they're banged around a little bit. You know.
Well, indestructible in their housings.
But. Yes, in their housing. But I mean, it seems to me that, I mean, aside from changing out the SD card, you really just use it in its housing all the time.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I have the previous one, and I took it out today. I took it out of the housing because I knew we were going to talk about it, you know, just to kind of get reacquainted. And they're so tiny. But yeah, you kind of leave it in the housing because the housing is almost really an integral part of it. And it's so well thought out. The back comes off, so you can add. So I have the LCD backpack as well on mine. And so that I have an additional back that goes on the housing that makes it, you know, larger for the LCD backpack. Presumably that will also be the case with the Wi-Fi backpack when it comes out.
Right. So let's back up a sec, because you use the term backpack, and that's their marketing term for these little add-on modules that you just literally slap on the back of the GoPro. So Each module does a different thing. So there's there's one that has an extra battery, there's one that has an LCD, but you were going to talk about the new one that was announced at CES.
Yeah, the Wi-Fi backpack and the Wi-Fi remote is really very cool. Because one of the things about this, so if you're Mythbusters and you're tacking these onto your car, you know, you're getting ready to do your shot, someone has to run around and start each one of these cameras. This way with the Wi-Fi backpack, it doesn't matter. I mean, when it says Wi-Fi, yes, it means Wi-Fi, but think about it in the field, all you have to do is create a hotspot, whether it's in the car or it's on your camera rig or whatever. So you can have control over all of the cameras at once. So you just start them, stop them, you know, when you're ready. It's really, really clever, and that's important. Why not just use Wi-Fi? Let's not screw around with any other things. And then they add to that the fact that it can stream over Wi-Fi. So you can be recording a stream to your SD card, and you can also be looking at a stream off of each camera, which is just awesome.
Well, that's just phenomenal, because that way, you know, the director can actually choose what camera angles they want at particular time frames. So they can basically start editing live.
Right. Editing really in your head, or you know, you're picking your shots. Or not only that, I mean, you know, you can use them to plan things. So you could have a reference camera or a witness camera for, you know, in the car to go, okay, this is the point where he really put his foot on the floor because I saw him do it. Yeah. So it's really, really, I think it will really make a lot of difference for shows like that, motorsport shows, sports shows, but
pornography.
You know, also pornography. Also reality TV shows, you know. I was going to say you can, but they have been. You slap these things on people and they walk around with them for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And they've been used, you know, we're talking a lot about the new one, but the current model has been used a lot on television. A lot of things.
Yeah, it's really amazing. So the size of them, I mean, I'm trying to think about how big are they really? They're roughly the size of a pack of cigarettes, but who smokes anymore?
Smaller
so
than that.
I was going to say, yeah, they're a little bit
two
smaller.
2x1.5.
Well, the housing adds bulk, but you're talking about a small thing anyway, so the bulk is relative.
Yeah, I mean, it fits in the palm of your hand. You can, not just in the palm, but you can grasp it in the palm of your hand.
Yeah.
It's so small.
So you can attach it to a helmet and not have it be completely whacked out. You know, they can still move, so it's not very heavy at all.
Right.
It's really flexible. If you've ever seen any of those YouTube videos where these guys are skydiving or bungee jumping or what have you, they all use GoPros. And so you see that live helmet cam action going on. And you can see also, you know, the quality is really quite good, even fully additionally compressed, you know, to send to YouTube.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the sensor is good. The lens in it is okay. The new lens is better. But yeah, I mean, it's just an overall really good idea that seemed like, in hindsight, seems like a no-brainer. But, you know, they just executed really well on this thing. It shoots 1080p down to WVGA. So 1080p, 960p, 720p, WVGA. And it looks great. And the new camera, it works even better in low light.
Yeah, as I say, the lens on the new one is actually a lot better. The field of views are also quite wide as well, without it being crazy weird fisheye.
Right.
I think that's one of the nice things about it. You still get that wide angle, but you don't get the distortion that you get with a fisheye lens, which is nice.
And especially if you're shooting for a broadcast, it's even better because you can start out, if you'll say, I want the whole 170-degree field of vision, then shoot it in 1080p. If you want to drop it to different resolutions, you can change the, you know, like you can drop it down to like 127 degrees or 90 degrees at 720p. So basically it just uses less of the sensor, so you're using a different portion of the lens, so it changes the field of view. And so it's really clever and it works really well. I mean, some people have also, you know, gone in and removed the lens and put a flat lens on it to for that, but
is that like a sanctioned thing? Are people selling kits?
No. Well, they're selling kits. You can do it yourself.
Oh, wow.
And there's also adapter lenses that have come off, you know, after, of course. But, you know, then, of course, you're getting into chromatic aberrations and stuff. So,
right.
But they're great cameras for what they are.
Yeah, I'm really excited. As a matter of fact, I want to buy, you know, half a dozen of them just to have them. I mean, they're so small and they're so cheap. Why not? We were talking on the show when Kanan was on about how now even the low-end gear that's available to mere mortals is so much better than the super professional gear of 10 years ago.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
That, you know, there's no reason that you shouldn't be upping your game. And so with something like a GoPro, it's so cheap. You know, there's no reason to not have coverage.
I was thinking about this today. It's quite conceivable for, say, a documentary crew that has no money to walk out with two GoPros and actually film a decent, you know, thing. You know, if they're not, you know, obviously if you're doing, you know, sit down interviews, it's going to look kind of funny. But
people with no money have a really, really, really clever sense about them. So they can figure out how to deal with the limitations of the 170 degree lens. Again, like what you said, dropping down the resolution so that they can, you know, bring it down to make it flatter and then, you know, just kind of bodge something together.
Right. And it's like, well, you know, yes, it's cheap. And yes, this little camera is cheap. But the quality of it is really good. If you look at it with that, with a bit of, you know, a snobbish eye, you know, yes, it's a $300 camera, but it's a great $300 camera.
Again, you know, the idea is that it's inexpensive, it's nearly indestructible, and it's a hell of a lot of a better video camera than, say, the iPod Touch or something.
Exactly.
Where the camera on this thing is awful.
Right.
I have one, and I'm always woefully disappointed by it. And that isn't to say that the iPhone 4S camera is bad, because it's a completely different camera. So don't be fooled. The 4S is, you know, the 4S is not going to beat out any real camera, but it's, you know, in a pinch, because it's the camera you've got on you, because you'd probably have your phone on you, it's a pretty good camera. I like it. It works for its intended purpose, which is, again, is to take those spontaneous serendipitous shots. Anything else, and I'm going to be packing my 5D, because I've got a backpack that's large enough so I can do that.
And also just imagine the things you could do, like setting up your video village, for instance. You know, a lot of directors like to, you know, direct from the village. They don't get behind the camera, you know. Just imagine the things that you could do. Let's say that you're doing an odd shoot and you've got three cameras because you're doing some FX shot and it's one time only, or you know, you don't have a lot of, yeah, drop a few of these around the set. And you can sit there in Video Village and switch back and forth between them to see what's going on out there for your witness cameras. And they cost $300 plus the Wi-Fi backpack, which I don't know what it costs because it's not out yet.
But. Yeah, it's not out yet. Theoretically, it's going to be out sometime in April.
Right.
But yeah, we're not in April yet, so that's a problem. I'm actually quite surprised that they still haven't given a predicted MSRP for it, though.
Yeah, I didn't look really hard. I don't know if they mentioned anything at CS, but...
Yeah, they didn't have it on their website when I looked. So they had the announcement that it exists and this is what it'll do, but they didn't have a price for it.
The rumor I hear is it's $100, which nice. I think would be perfect.
Yeah.
So you can imagine you can spend $400 on a witness camera that you can stick anywhere and watch over Wi-Fi. I mean, that's just brilliant.
Right. Now, remember, because it's a backpack, it affixes to the back of the GoPro itself. So you need to have one for each of your GoPros. You want to do that. So it's an additional, let's say for sake of argument, $100 when all is said and done, tax and shipping and all that mess. Still, you know, for that type of flexibility, that's not bad at all.
I'm really, really excited by this camera. I mean, I know it's kind of just a evolutionary, the camera itself is the next step, but the Wi-Fi backpack and better lens system, it's really exciting.
Yes, it's evolutionary, but it's the fact that people can now use these things and do things that they weren't able to do before, with especially with a Wi-Fi backpack, right? Imagine controlling up to 50 GoPros via your iPad.
That's huge. Right. That's and that's the other thing. Yeah, there'll be an iPad app. There'll be a computer app. There'll be an iPhone along with, you know, there's a physical remote that you can use. Like if you have one of these things, there's this physical remote you can use. Or actually, my understanding is the remote might work for more than one, but I don't know for sure. But yeah, you can control up to 50 of these cameras. Just the ideas that people, the things that people will use these for, will be really interesting to see.
It's going to be pretty amazing. And I'm definitely going to buy a couple of them at least. Very similar to how people are excited and interested in the whole Arduino thing, because it allows, you know, it's a simple kit that mortals can kind of grasp and understand and then build stuff off of and create things. The GoPro, because it's such a low cost item, enables budding documentary filmmakers or even people who are just interested in checking out its capabilities and trying a few things. You know, maybe they don't consider themselves a filmmaker yet, but it allows them to get into that world where...
For only $300 or yeah. $400. Yeah, I mean, that's just...
Which is mind-blowing.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about, of course, we have to preface all this. You know, we're talking about this camera as how great it is. You know, we're not, of course, comparing it to, you know, a 5D Mark II.
Or Arri Alexa or something like that. Yeah,
we mean is this is a very tiny camera with a very nice sensor, produces great images. It's so versatile. I mean, it really was a game changer when people started adopting. There were several of these types of cameras out for a while, but GoPro was the one that got it right first. And they just really delivered on the design. So yeah, it's just a great little thing.
On the other end of the spectrum, we've got the Canon C300, which is a $16,000 camera, slightly different than the GoPro of $300 or $400. It was announced a while back at CES, and we talked a little bit about it in our CES show. Now it's actually in the hands of people who have been using it to film real projects. From what I hear, it's a really fantastic camera. On paper, people were saying, oh, that's, you know, it sounds all right, but the Scarlett just came out and it's less expensive. At face value, it's less expensive.
On paper.
Exactly. You know, the Scarlett can do 4K and this and that and the other thing. And so this looks like an expensive also-ran. As people are coming back with real footage, they're saying that regardless of the specs, the quality of the image that comes out of the C300 is phenomenal.
Yeah, everything I've seen has been quite beautiful and different than, better than I expected. And I think, too, it's worth mentioning, you know, that the 5D Mark II was never a competitor, really, for the Red. There were two different cameras for two different worlds, in a way. There are some people that would use either that exist in the world, but for most people, they were very different spaces that they filled. And I think this, the C300, I think, is more of a move or an evolution in the space that the 5D Mark II lives in than is the space that the Red lives in. Now, it is a filmmaker's camera, and don't get me wrong, it's, you know, it's not a DSLR, but I think that maybe comparing it with the Reds is just not really a level playing field in many respects. But this thing looks gorgeous. And I don't know if you saw Stu's write-up about it, but I mean, just really, really, really gorgeous output.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, that's what you need, right?
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, literally, that is all you care about. What does it look like?
Right. And that's why I have such scorn for the fanboys of any camp. You know, the Red fanboys are particularly notorious because the vast majority of them have never actually owned a Red camera. On paper, the Canon is inferior in probably every regard. It's more expensive. It only goes up to 1080p. Therefore, it doesn't have 4K. It doesn't do, except the reality of the situation is that real people who need to film real things are using it, and they're having success with it. And it excels. It meets or exceeds all of their expectations. And I think that's important to note. At some point in time, specs don't matter. And what does matter is, can it do the job you need it to do? And will it meet or exceed those expectations?
Right. The specs matter up to the point where, okay, it's capable of doing something great. And then the execution of the maker is what really matters in the end. And like, and in some ways, you know, it's mimicked by things like, well, this computer has the processor's not as fast as this one. Well, you know, but why is it snappier than the one that is faster? You know, it's all in the overall execution. And I think that's where Canon's really pulled it out here. I'm in love with this camera. I can't afford this camera, but yeah. Just watching some of the footage that's been posted, and it's just gorgeous.
It's physically beautiful. I think it's physically absolutely gorgeous. And again, I think the footage that comes out of it is fantastic. Again, it's the pixels that matter. It's the quality of that image at the end of the day. And when it comes down to it, yes, it's 1080p camera. The quality of those pixels are very, very good. It's got a nice high dynamic range. And I don't mean HDR. I mean, it has a good dynamic range that exceeds the vast majority of its competitors, its direct competitors, and it has tremendous low light capability. I recently saw a film that was it used the C300, and it shot entirely in moonlight.
That's just amazing.
And it's gorgeous.
Absolutely amazing.
It's phenomenal.
The funniest thing is like you can tell that the hardest part really is the focus. It's like there's so little light. And if they're pulling any manual focus, I don't think the person could see as well as the camera could.
Yeah. And of course the person has to, because there's no auto anything on that camera. It's all manual. Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, it's filling that Alexa space. Oh God, wow, man, I use that word space a lot, but it really is, you know, like if you're a documentary filmmaker who's been shooting on a mid-range Arri or something, this is like right up your alley.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. And again, it's compact. It can use PL mount lenses or it can use EF lenses. Now, granted, actually, there's one caveat to that. Canon makes two entirely separate bodies, one that takes EF lenses and one that takes PL mount lenses. So you have to sort of choose up front which one you want to use. If you've invested in a whole bunch of EF L series glass, then you'll probably want to go with the EF mount. If you have a bunch of PL stuff, then you're going to naturally want to go toward the PL mount.
Have you seen Tim Arashbin's rig that he designed for this thing?
Is that the red one? Red slab? It's gorgeous.
Yes, it's absolutely
so
wonderful.
Gorgeous.
And I like the fact that the size of this camera, basically all of that stuff you used to have on the back of your shoulder is gone. So now you can just stack up batteries.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, you have to do that for counterbalance.
Well, yeah, for the counterbalance, but that's by design.
Right, right.
Yeah, because there's so little camera up front and it doesn't weigh that much that you can counterbalance with this by stacking batteries.
Yeah. You know, it's funny.
It's really nice.
It's funny, the low light capabilities, and you know, we were talking about the film that was done entirely in moonlight, it reminds me a lot of American Graffiti. That was done by faking ambient light. It was so dark when they were filming, because it was filmed, you know, the entire thing takes place at one night, right? An afternoon and a night, and then the morning after. So during the time where they're cruising down the street late at night, the ambient light was so low, basically nothing was perfectly in focus except for Harrison Ford's eyelash. And they had to, what they had to do was they wound up, instead of trying to put in additional lights into the scene, what they did was they replaced, actually they augmented the street lights that were naturally there and then augmented them with these gigantic Kleegs so they actually shone onto the street as if they were normal street lights, just at 8 bajillion candle power.
Right. And you have to hand it to them. I mean, that was a very complex shoot in that year, shooting in this town. They basically had this town, the one you see in the movie and, you know, the strips, and doing what you're talking about there. And so what's the star of your show? Well, it's a bunch of people and a bunch of shiny cars.
Yep. Lots of specular chrome highlights.
Chrome and glass and
the Lucas I love.
Yes.
Oh my, but yeah, it really is one of my favorite films of all time. You know, being quite the Amerophile, there's a certain West Coast car loving ode that is, I mean, that's what that film is. You know, it's a coming of age film, but it's all about the cars, it's about the people, it's just, it was shot so beautifully. And it also had a bunch of stars in it that you'd never think of. You know, Harrison Ford's in it. I think Mackenzie Phillips is in it. She's the young girl, the underage girl that hangs out with Harrison Ford. Rather, Harrison Ford is stuck with her. And then, you know, a whole bunch. The amount of people in it, I mean, it's huge. It's absolutely huge. If you haven't seen it, stop what you're doing. Watch this film. It's brilliant. Love it. You will absolutely love it. It's a feel-good film. I don't think there's anything really wrong with it. You may not like something about the film, but there's nothing wrong with this film.
No, yeah. I mean, yeah. Well, The Witness, you know, when it came out, it was enormous. It was huge. That's how he got to make Star Wars, because American Graffiti was a huge hit. You know, it just touches on something, I think, that people of a certain age who were at the right age then, and also, like you say, people with the Amerophiles or people who stock and trade is, you know, that sort of nostalgia thing was great. Now imagine if he'd had this camera to shoot it on.
Oh my God, how cool would that be? But yeah.
Although then again, you know, there are some points in that movie where it gets dark and grainy, and it's kind of neat, I think.
It has a feel to it. It has this lovely organic quality about it. You know, nowadays,
It's kind of like, you know, when you stay out too late and things get kind of weird and fuzzy. That movie has that feeling.
Right. As the night goes on. Yeah, you're right. Totally right. You know, things get a little bit more surreal. They get a little bit more nerve-wracking. But at the same time, there's also an overall calm that happens. Right. And yeah, it's just absolutely amazing. And Wolfman Jack sort of ties it all together.
Yes.
And my God, what a voice. What an absolute fantastic voice. And you think about it, you know, that was back in the days where they didn't really regulate the power out of the AM stations. So you could have an AM station in Texas that could easily reach New York. and that's basically what Wolfman Jack did, apparently. And this is coming just directly from the knowledge in my reptile brain. Apparently, as rumor had it, Wolfman Jack used to broadcast out of a radio station just over the border into Mexico. So they actually couldn't get him. The FCC couldn't get him. Yeah. I mean, that's just mad, mad cool. Yeah. So, you know, it's like 80 bajillion watts and go throughout the entire country. And nowadays, you know, everything is hyper-regulated. And ultimately, that's a good thing because you get a more regional sense, except that now Clear Channel owns everything. So you're getting regional nothing. So it's unfortunately, that has backfired a little bit. It was an interesting time from a nostalgic look back. It certainly seemed like an interesting time. Human rights aside, but from a car perspective, from a, you know, but
so that's our love letter this week.
Yes,
to American Graffiti. I've noticed a theme. I mean, we do have a love letter to something in every episode.
Yeah, I think so, and I like that because we try so hard to tear things apart. So it's nice to have that counterbalance. Otherwise, it would just be a horrible, horrible rip into everything, and that gets tedious after a while. So. So we talked about the C300. I also want to talk about the Sony FS100, which at the time I was looking at trying to find a bit of a history. I'm primarily a stills photographer that got into video through various means. I was doing a lot of video production way back in the day prior to HD material, and got out of it for quite a while, and then got back into it when I purchased my 5D Mark II and loved it as a stills camera, and then started experimenting with video and realized that it was really capable for my purposes. What I wound up doing when I became more confident, I started shooting things that went out to thousands of people. Suddenly that got real very quickly. And I started to run into some of the inherent limitations of the Mark II's DSLR format. One of the huge ones is the moiré problem. A lot of what I did was I shot monitors, iPads.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I shot iPads, I shot other LCD monitors, iPhones, did a lot of iPad and iPhone promo videos and such. And the moiré, because if you've got a very sharp lens and you're trying to have very shallow depth of field, what happens is you wind up focusing on the pixel grid in the monitor itself, and that will give you this crazy moiré problem. Moiré is basically a scintillation of color due to interference by closely spaced parallel lines.
Well, I was going to say for people who don't understand, but I think most people who listen to our podcast probably understand it.
Yeah, and probably encountered it too.
Yeah, it's crazy making. There's nothing you can do about it. I was like watching, what was I watching where they were talking? Oh, something leaked off Stu's blog. It was a
Was it the 5D Mark III video that fellow?
Yeah,
did?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and his jacket.
The jacket.
Oh,
but,
God!
But I love this jacket.
What a horrible! I mean, who thought that was okay?
But that's what's hilarious about it, because that's so the kind of thing that just happens and you have no control over it.
Yeah. The only thing you can do, and this is what I wound up doing, and I felt horrible because here I have this wonderful glass, you know, this wonderful L-series glass, and I've got this wide open aperture so that I have, you know, just this tiny, tiny, tiny field of focus because I've got this lovely large imaging sensor. So I have a very small depth of field, which I've always loved as a stills photographer and continue to love as a videographer. What I wound up having to do was defocus. I had to defocus on the thing I was supposed to focus on so that I wouldn't get the scintillating color, the moiré pattern. And that was the only solution to the problem. And luckily, a lot of the videos that I was doing were just going out on the web. They weren't broadcast. So it really wasn't a problem. You know, you'd never see it gigantic enough. And the compression artifacts and such like that would take care of my problem for me, which was lucky. But that would never fly in broadcast, ever.
Right. Yeah.
So that brought me to say, oh, okay, well, if I'm doing all these video things, then I should probably grow up and put on the big boy pants and get a real video camera, because I'm clearly hitting the limitations of the 5D. As much as I love it, I can still use it as a stills camera, but it's not working out for the type of video I need to shoot. I was looking, well, I don't have a lot of budget for this because really I'm doing it on my own. I'm bringing my expertise and my talent to the job at hand. I'm not being hired specifically to be the video guy. It's just that I happen to have some equipment and I happen to have some ability. Right. So I'm thinking, well, how much do I want to budget for a video camera? And what are the specs that I need to make it worthwhile? And I was looking around and I was thinking, you know, that Sony FS100 is a really interesting camera on paper because it's a super 35mm sensor, which means it's nice and big. You're going to have a nice shallow depth of field-ish. You'll have very good low light capability. You'll have a nice clean image coming into it. You know, it's also small and compact, and it's around $5,000. You know, so I was like, wow, that seems to be the camera that I'm looking for, hoping for, that I was hoping that the C300 would be. I was hoping the original Scarlett would be.
Right.
Maybe, and since those have been dashed, maybe this would be the new hotness. You know, I could deal with that. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you take a look at the specs on paper and then you start reading and you're like, this could be it. And then actual people who have used the camera start blogging about it, and they've got a lot of good things to say, but they have an awful lot of bad things to say that, unfortunately for my purposes, the bad things kind of overwhelm the good aspects of the camera, the build quality being one. Build quality for me is really important. I tend to knock around my gear, and having something that is small and plasticky is not really going to work out for me. The mounts for the microphone, those tend to be loose, you know, out of the box loose, not, you know.
Yeah, the whole idea that the build quality on the body itself is so low is really disturbing, though, because it used to be something that you would never hear from Sony.
Right.
But we have some Sony gear at work, and I've noticed that slowly over time, you know, it's been getting less and less. For instance, we just bought this little, you know, Sony tripod that has a built-in LAN connector and all this stuff in the handle. And, it was cheap, but come to find, well, it's cheap for a reason, because it's built like shit.
Right. Yeah, there's no value. Right. I mean, it may be
really
less,
worrisome.
Yeah. It may not be expensive, but if there's no value there, then it's not even worth the cost that it is.
Right. And then we were also looking at the lower line of the next series, the VG20. And I think we discussed that once before. And I said I was looking to buy one. But one, the build quality on the FS100 has been talked about so much. And then come to find, you know, people comparing that to they're like, well, this is bad. But you want to know what's really bad is the VG20.
Don't.
So I think we're just going to skip that. Yeah. I mean, on paper, it looked like you say it, like, all right, this camera is going to be ideal for this particular use, but now I'm just really starting to kind of dance on one foot about it. It was worrisome though, because I think Sony's important in this space. They've always been kind of one of the three or four manufacturers who are always knocking heads against each other and pushing each other, but it's kind of worrisome.
I wonder about Sony's long-term viability. I mean, right now they're still so gigantic that they'll still survive for quite some time. But it's been very clear for the last, I want to say last decade or so, maybe more than that even, the quality level of their stuff has really taken a hit. I remember back in the day, if you bought a Sony XBR television, which was their premium line television, it was amazing build quality. It was absolutely top notch. Out of the box, it would come pretty close to being dead on actual spec. You know, what you were looking for. It didn't have like, oh, well, the blue channel is like way out of whack or what have you. Or if it was, it had the controls and the ability to dial that back in to conform to NTSC normal color space. You know, their tube technology was so good that you didn't have any distortion on the geometry, which was absolutely fantastic. So if you ever wanted, you know, a quality piece of gear, you bought Sony. And the same thing, you know, with their Walkman and their Discman, and eventually...
And their cameras.
And to this day, you know, they still make some good kits. That's without question. But a lot of the stuff that is what I would call affordable in scare quotes, where, you know, anything, let's say, under $25,000 or so, you know, granted $25,000 is a car, but anything below that in the realm of, you know, stuff that we could theoretically afford is just not there in comparison to the competitors who are in that space.
Yeah, like you say, it's kind of indicative of a change that may affect their long-term, you know, viability. And that's what I mean by it's worrisome. They've been important to the camera market. And I don't know, I just, this whole thing makes me start to worry. Now, that said, I mean, you could take this camera and you could make good things with this camera.
Sure.
But you're probably not getting the value that you think you're getting for that price. You know, I was reading, you know, one comparison, and they had all three of the cameras, you know, the 5N, the FS100, and the VG20. And, you know, the guy's, one of his, not his final remarks was, but a midway remark was, well, basically what you're getting is a slightly better image, slightly less moiré, slightly better alias, and slightly better low light, and for $5,000. It's like, you know, it's not earth-shattering.
Well, especially now that Canon introduced the Mark III, the 5D Mark III.
Yes.
I mean, that is going to be... I mean, that's the bomb right there. I mean, that
well,
is
of course,
the shot.
Now, these two cameras kind of fit in differently, you know, when if you're a long form producer, then probably not looking at a 5D Mark II, but
looking. I mean, if you're a long form producer, you're looking at a real camera, you're gonna have to step
we're
up.
We're kind
again.
Of saying, don't look at the
yeah,
unless that's really just, you know, what fits in your range and you can't find anything
right.
else.
But that's what I'm saying, you know, for the $5,000 price range, because that's, to be honest, when you get done with the 5D Mark III, you're going to be in the around $5,000 range as well, because the body itself is $3,500. Plus, for me, I've got big hands and I need the battery grip. So I need to have that extra piece, the cost of which has been doubled since the 5D Mark II grip. And
wow.
I have conflicting reports that say that the BGE6 grip, which fit the Mark II, will fit on the Mark III, but I also hear that it doesn't. So I'm trying to clarify that because I would like to not shell out $600 for a grip.
Yeah, that would be...
Because that's a little ridiculous because it's just a battery grip. It doesn't have unicorns and clovers in it. you know, it's funny because you go to B&H and you see the Canon grip for the Mark II because, you know, the Mark III stuff isn't actually shipping yet.
Right.
You see that the battery grip for the Mark II is $260. And then you see the non-Canon grips that are, you know, name brand and manufacturers making these grips that work with the 5D Mark II and have all the same buttons for $60, $80.
Right.
You know, I'm like, really? Come on.
Well, because at the end of the day, it really is just a thing that fits around your camera and holds some stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
well, it also, not, I mean, it does have to interface with the camera's electronics.
Okay, I take that back. It's a thing that fits around your camera and holds some stuff and has some buttons and wires.
Yeah, exactly. It has a relay in it. Big deal. You know, it has a 3-cent relay in it. You know, that's really all there is to it. It's just not, it's ridiculous. But I'm going to pay for it if I have to. And that sucks, but that's the price of poker. And why do I want it? Because it's new and shiny.
Well, and that said, the Canon grips, it's nice. It looks just like the, you know, so, yeah. But still, it's crazy for the price to jump like that.
Yeah, for what it is, right? So I'm guessing, and this is pure speculation, the 5D Mark II is partially weather resistant. So the line below the 5D is not at all weather resistant at all, period, full stop. Good luck getting it near water. They don't have any guarantees. You know, if it gets wet. The 5D has proper weather sealing around the mount, around all the buttons and all that. It isn't total, complete weather sealing. The 1DX does. You can basically immerse it entirely in water. I don't suggest you do it, but you can do it. But it's possible.
I think talking about the 1DX is we're breaking the or we're jumping over the Top Gear rule, you know, like, oh, look at this lovely Chevrolet and here's a Ferrari Testarossa. God, what a gorgeous camera.
The 1DX is a lovely, lovely thing. And if you think about it, okay, so the 1DX is $6,500, right? And it's Canon's flagship. It's not shipping yet, but it will be shortly. It's Canon's flagship. It basically comes with the battery grip in it already. So you're now basically saying, okay, $6,500 versus now $4,000, $4,100, right? So now we've just narrowed down the difference in the bodies. Still, $2,000, that's a pretty big bump. But in for a penny, in for a pound. If you're already spending $4,000, $6,000 isn't so ridiculous.
Well, I mean, and if you're a still shooter, if you're a fashion photographer or whatever, you know, you're not looking at the Mark III.
If you're fashion, you can totally look at the Mark III. What makes the 1DX better than the Mark III for stills photography is frames per second. So if you're a sport shooter, you're going to go with a 1DX hands down. The 5D is not an option for you. But if you're doing studio work, I mean, the 5D is meant to be and is positioned as being the studio camera. The 5D Mark II had, unfortunately, its predecessor's autofocus system, which was, it was all right, but by the time the Mark II came around, you know, the technology had gone into the stratosphere and it was still chugging along with, you know, 4 or 5 year old technology then.
Right. So, meanwhile, the ISO that it can shoot at, I mean, it's just jumping, you know, low light conditions, and the autofocus is just not built for that.
Right.
Or it wasn't built for that.
Right. Here you have this camera that is amazingly good in low light that can't autofocus.
It just can't find its way.
It was so sad, you know, and that's precisely what I do. I do a lot of event photography and I'm in dark places photographing bands, right? And in some places, like for example, I shoot at the Highline Ballroom in Manhattan, and they are lit up like the sun, and they have a great lighting guy and it's beautiful, and I'm usually shooting at ISO 200. You know, and I'm getting perfect shots.
Yeah, it's a dream.
Oh, it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. The musicians there are just rocking out and it's beautiful, right? And then you get into these other clubs that there may be a 40-watt light bulb, you know, on stage.
Hanging from the ceiling in the middle of the room.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because there was a club in Athens, Georgia called the 40-watt club.
Oh, yes. Everyone knows the 40-watt club.
So for those of you who don't know, the 40-watt club in Athens, Georgia, it was where fun bands like REM and B-52s and Love Tractor all got their start. So good times. I don't know if it still exists, unfortunately.
I think it, or last time I looked, it did. I saw that it did, but I don't know.
Right on. Well, that's good.
But yeah, because the 40 watt comes from the joke on the lighting.
Yeah, because there was a single 40 watt bulb in the entire club. Oops.
So now, of course, the new camera shoots an even lower light.
Yeah,
so.
Not only does it shoot an even lower light, they've completely changed the sensor. They haven't really upped the megapixels too much. It's gone from
which
like 21.
Fine.
Yeah, which is fine. You know, 21 megapixels to about 22 in change. However, the quality of those pixels just radically superior in every conceivable way. It's using gapless mirrors, so the chromatic aberration is significantly lessened. One of the big problems of shooting in the 5D, and my friend Michael, who's also a photographer, he likes to shoot wide open in the middle of the day, and he likes to shoot chrome objects. So he likes to shoot motorbikes in, you know, the noonday sun at f1.4. The problem with that is you get color fringing. So it usually comes in the form of green or purple color fringing around specular highlights. So Right. It's
what you're going to get. You're going to get shooting chrome, but if you're, yeah, there are ways to mitigate it, but those are not the ways to mitigate it.
Right. And the thing is that if you have a 7D, because it's got an APS-C size sensor, you actually don't have that problem as much. The fringing is significantly reduced because of the wide open aperture, because you've got a smaller sensor. The depth of field is actually larger, so you don't have the convergence problems that you normally get, the chromatic aberration problems, excuse me, that you normally get. So the new technology in the sensor of the Mark III is absolutely phenomenal. It should reduce a lot of that. It probably physically cannot get rid of all of it, because part of the thing of a specular highlight is that it's basically blowing out. There's really no tone there. So probably not going to completely remove it, but if you can get rid of at least some of it, that would be a significant improvement. And yeah, he's really looking forward to seeing some pictures that show that. You know, low ISO, shooting wide open, noonday sun, reflective object with a lot of specular highlight. You know, and we've not seen any of those yet.
Well, and they're also making some claims, you know, the new Digic 5 Plus is supposed to be so much faster, which does allow it to do more processing on each image than before. So that's always a good thing.
Yeah, the Digic 5 is, I believe it's 17 times faster than its predecessor, the Digic 4, which is ridiculous. And the 1DX actually has, I believe it has two Digic 5 Pluses and it's got a Digic 4 in it.
Oh, wow.
Which is, and again, if you're dealing with $6,500 versus 41 and maybe, okay, so an extra battery or so. So you're dealing with, you know, $4,200 versus $6,500. You're getting a significantly faster piece of kit and you're getting something that's entirely weather sealed for just a little bit of a bump more. If you're making money shooting, then probably makes sense to go 1DX. Interesting thing about it, though, is that if you're doing video, then...
Oh, yeah.
The 3 is where it's at all day long.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you know, some of the things like the CMOS skew, they've cut that down. That was one of the, you know, complaints and things like that. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, you know, if you're looking at these two cameras thinking they're for the same thing, they're not.
They're really not at all. I mean, you can certainly do video on the 1DX, and it's going to produce very good video because of the way that they're bringing in video into the camera again, which actually the 5D Mark III is also using. Okay, so backing up, the 5D Mark II used line skipping. So it's got a full frame sensor. It doesn't actually use every line of that sensor in order to get a 1080p image, because obviously that there are way more pixels than a 1080p image needs. So what it does is it it fires off every third line. And you know, that's perfectly acceptable for a lot of things. But in the case where you've got, you're shooting parallel lines, or you know, you've got any sort of tight detail, that line skipping is going to create those chromatic aberrations. It's going to create that moiré pattern, you know, and
aliasing issues as well.
Exactly.
Apart from moiré.
Right. And so you'll wind up getting these weird, crazy stair-stepping, this aliasing stuff. The new way they're doing it is they are actually using the entire frame, the entire sensor, but then what they're doing is they're averaging the image, basically very similar to how Photoshop will change the document size. You know, right. So it'll do some interpolation or reduction in the case of the Mark III, and apparently does a tremendous job of it. So, you know, all that stuff that we used to fight with, we learn to route around it, right? Like anything else. You know, if something has a limitation, you just don't do that thing.
Right.
You know, you route around it. It's like, oh, I have to film overhead wires. Well, I'm not going to be using the 5D Mark II. I've got to film a brick building. Yeah, I'm not going to be using the 5D Mark II.
Yeah.
But now, based upon what I'm seeing, it's all that's gone. All that looks perfectly viable, you know,
right.
And that's
agreed.
Really, really impressive. I mean,
yeah.
I just can't
enough
even
so that
it.
They've, yeah, that enough so that they've talked about it. I mean, they've brought it up, you know,
yeah.
Versus, you know, so they're confident enough about it. They brought it up.
And then some of them, I was going to say, and some of the videos that are available now on Canon's website, they even have, you know, we're going to shoot this entirely in cobblestone. And
right.
it looks pretty good, I have to say.
Yeah, that was a stew shed. You know, if you want to impress me, show me cobblestone. And they did.
And sure enough, they did. Yeah, I'm really impressed. I can't wait to get my hands on it. I'm also looking forward to the new autofocus system.
Yes, which is the same as in
the 1DX.
Yes.
Oh, so good. Because we said that the 5D Mark II used the 5D Mark I's autofocus system, which was okay for the Mark I. It wasn't even great for the Mark I. It was okay for the Mark I.
It was adequate for the Mark I, yeah.
Usable but silly for the Mark II. And now we've got big boy autofocus, finally.
Yeah.
So 61 autofocus points, 41 of which are cross-type. The way autofocus works, it's looking for contrast. And so if it can't find contrast on an x-axis or a y-axis, it can't find focus. So if you have a cross-type, it'll look on both axes at once. So you're pretty much guaranteed to find a bit of contrast versus to have to hunt for something for it to grab onto, which
right.
I often did because of the limitations of the 5D Mark II. You know, you wind up saying, oh, okay, well, I know this is a bit of contrast, you know, bit, so I'm going to focus lock on that because I know that that is going to be more or less in the same focal plane as what I'm trying to grab, and then recompose and then shoot.
Yeah.
And sometimes that works and sometimes that doesn't. And having a 61 point autofocus with a 41-point cross type is just absolutely phenomenal.
Wow.
Yeah.
No, I won't want.
Yeah, see.
But I'm not going to.
Save your pennies. And, well, one of the other big hits for video is that it has different codecs. So it has the normal IPB codec, which is, you know, iframes, P frames, B frames. So it's going to compress temporally. So it's going to look at frames ahead and frames behind in order to make a reasonable assumption on, you know, file size and try to get everything in order that way, which is lovely, again, for trying to get maximum quality out of the smallest file size, except when you want to edit it or want to grade
right.
it or do anything in post,
right.
Then things get really difficult because you have what is basically one iframe and then a metric crap ton of delta frames. You know, they're not full frames. They're pieces, parts of frames that happen to be different than the frame that it's referencing. So if you're doing any color grading, that means that there's just less information there. So it has...
Pieces, parts.
And parts as parts.
Please carry on.
Canon has introduced an all iframe codec. So all iframe, it basically means that each frame is a full frame. It doesn't reference any other frame. It's just there. Consequently, the file size is gigantic. The file size is something
right.
like 585 megabytes per minute versus 285 I should have had this in my notes. Per minute on with the standard compression. Obviously, significantly larger file size, but it should yield a much, much better grade.
Yeah, and you've got an awful lot of offerings for that grading. Yeah, I'm pretty jealous.
Well, you can.
It's not the device for me, man. But oh, it's so nice.
You can play with mine next time I'm out there. That was not a double entendre at all.
I get to play with Christopher when he's here.
Woo-hoo. We should all be so lucky. The other huge thing, and this is a fundamental limitation of the FAT32 file system, which is the file system on the compact flash card for the 5D Mark II.
Yes.
We can now record for nearly half an hour. It actually shuts off at 29 minutes and 59 seconds. And
I wanted to actually ask you this. Mm-hmm. So it will run the full time.
Yes, it'll run the full time. So what it does now, which it didn't do then,
which what is, every other camera on the market does.
Yeah, so sad. So FAT32 has a file size limit. It cannot deal with file sizes over 4 gigabytes. I actually thought that was originally over 2 gigabytes, but apparently it's 4 gigabytes.
Most people know the FAT16 had the 2 gigabyte limit, and then FAT32 was the 4 gigabyte limit. But there's also this other thing called XFAT, which is really interesting. But my whole thing is, you know,
so
what?
So it's skinny? What?
I don't know. My whole thing is, though, really, is why are we still beholden to fat?
Oh, it's awful. It's absolutely awful. The problem, though, is that every operating system knows how to read it.
Yeah. It just every time it comes up, it just kind of makes me crazy. But yeah. Oh, well, moving on. But no, that's not the really important thing, though. The really important thing is it has a headphone jack.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. this is the rub of the green. I am so used to recording separate audio that I was like, wow, headphone jack, big deal. You know, everyone in the universe is clamoring for it, except that I don't record into the camera. I don't record audio into the camera ever. Mm. I mean, I record like a scratch track, but, you know, I don't care what the scratch track sounds like. Mm. As long as it's recording, you know.
I know a lot of people are very, very happy about it.
Yeah, I just don't. I mean, I don't trust anything about the audio pipeline inside that camera to be clean. You know,
yeah.
I don't trust AD converters. I don't trust the amps. I don't trust anything more than my H4, for example.
But there are a lot of new type journalists out there whose editors are shoving them out in the field with a camera to take pictures. And then also while you're there and something happens, you know, you start shooting video. So I think for those people, that's kind of important.
Yeah, I suppose. The other thing is the way you go about going into movie mode is now radically simplified.
Right.
Getting movie mode into the 5D Mark II was a 16-step process. It was totally ridiculous. If you didn't set up a custom function in order to do it, you had to do it manually every time. And wow, what a giant pain in the ass that was. I don't often use the custom settings. So the 5D Mark II has a jog dial on the top, so it allows you to go from aperture priority to shutter priority to program mode to manual mode, etc., etc. But it also has 3 custom modes, and the custom modes are kind of cool because what it will do is you set up the camera however you want it, and then you, through the menu system, you say save this configuration as custom 1 or custom 2 or custom 3.
Right. And kind then, of a macro.
Exactly. And so from then on, you just twist to you know your custom mode, and bam, you're instantly set up with, you know, one small twist of a dial. You're instantly set up to how you want it to be. Now, the downside to that, though, is that because I'm a stills photographer and I need my battery to last me forever, I tend to have my camera go into a sleep mode after like a minute or so of inactivity. Not a lot of power is wasted for me doing nothing, waiting for my shot. So that's cool. And because the 5D starts up in, I think, less than 1/8 of a second or less than 1/10 of a second, it's no time at all for me to snap the picture when I'm finally ready to do that. But if you're on a custom mode and you're shooting video or what have you, and the camera shuts off, you have a problem. Because if you've changed any of those settings, like, for example, the exposure is changed because it's brighter or less bright, or you want to change your aperture or what have you, the camera shuts off, you hit it to turn it back on again, and it's reset to what you set it at when you set the custom mode.
Right, not the last thing you were in.
Right, which is a giant pain in the ass. So I don't know if they've fixed that, but simply being able to go into video mode is so much easier, I may not have to use the custom mode, which would be fantastic, because that's ultimately that's what I would like.
Also, they've I understand that when you're in video mode that the command wheel becomes like a...
It becomes touch wheel.
A jog wheel, yeah.
It becomes like the old iPods.
Nice.
Yeah, so that's very, very cool. I'm really looking forward to that. I actually, to be fairly frank, I would like to be able to turn that on full time, you know, rather than being, because right now it only triggers when you're in live view mode, which means that you're basically in movie mode.
That's true. I mean, if you're using it in some way, or, well, no, even just normally, I mean, you could still use it. Yeah, that's a good point. The assumption that you have your eye to the viewfinder is a poor assumption.
Right.
You know, you don't always have your eye to the viewfinder.
Right. And so, for example, say you are doing a long exposure and you want to change something. Right. You should be able to change that. And any time you bump the camera, that's going to be potentially a problem. So if you can just, without moving the camera, without...
Just kind of flick the wheel a little bit.
Exactly. You just merely touch the wheel and have it move to where you need it to be. You know, you've changed your aperture, if you changed your shutter speed or something.
Right.
You know, because that wheel is entirely programmable. You can assign it to do whatever you want to do with it, which is one of the great things about the Canon cameras is that pretty much every button on the thing is fully customizable. Commonly, what a lot of people do is they remove the half press to focus because they don't want their carefully focused thing to get screwed up just because they happen to do another half press. So they'll assign a focus lock to one of the buttons in the back, which can be really, really handy. So that way you're not ever going to change focus unless you specifically hit that extra button.
Now, what do you know about the HDMI out? I understand it's not still full clean HDMI out.
Right. But
which I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. Well, they specifically... Okay, so Canon's a giant freaking tease about this, right? So I believe it was The Verge who asked them straight up about this, and good for them. I, again, love letter to The Verge. Really, really dig you guys. The Canon rep said, it's not a clean HDMI out yet.
Okay, I did see a not yet in quotes on The Verge.
Yeah, that's interesting. And also keep in mind that, Magic Lantern has been able to override and do crazy things for the 5D Mark II firmware. So I imagine eventually, even though this is a new processor, the Digic 5, and it's going to be a whole new mess of problems to try to reverse engineer it, I imagine the Magic Lantern people will probably figure it out.
Or hopefully Canon will just...
Or Canon will just do it because they're listening.
Because that really just could change the versatility of this unit, you know, so much. I mean, it's a great thing already, don't get me wrong. But in this other type of shooting we were talking about where you've got multiples of things, be able to cram an HDMI cable around this thing and use it for its great sensor and its great lenses and all this stuff, you know, and the new Digic processor. Yeah, it would be a great thing to do.
And just offload recording. For some people. Right, and just offload recording. If you could get uncompressed HDMI out of that thing, how amazing would that be?
Just imagine. Yeah, it'd be like super bullet time. I mean, just... Can you imagine?
Oh, my God, yeah. Oof. I think... I don't want to say it's an inevitability, because it's certainly not. I'm hoping, however, considering the reaction of the Canon rep, it sounds to me like they are listening and they're going to try to make it happen, but they're not going to release it if it's not going to work out right. You know, so if it's going to be glitchy and horrible, they're not going to bother.
Or it was the thing that they were like, well, this is the least important thing. We'll get to that after the camera's out. I mean, hopefully it's that.
Right.
And like I say, when I say super bullet time, I mean like cheap shooting. I know people are using these 2K and 4K SI units. But what I mean is, it's a new camera, but its predecessor has been put through its paces. Everyone loves this thing, yada, yada, yada. It's a great unit. I can just imagine someone setting up, multi-camera shoots with these things, just pumping out HDMI. It'd be great.
Oh, yeah, it'd be absolutely phenomenal. And again, $3,500, cheap. Exactly,
in that range. Right. For people who are doing that, that's cheap.
Yeah.
And you can throw a nice EOS lens on that. Yeah, it just makes it compelling.
You know, we talked about a lot of gear, but really, they're just tools, right? It's like anything else. You know, a hammer, regardless of how it's made, is going to pound nails. But better tools give you a little bit more latitude in what you're trying to do. They allow you to do things that you wouldn't necessarily be able to do without the extra cost.
Photographers are often asked, what camera? You know, it's like, yes, these are just tools.
Yeah.
And we're talking about how great this or that is, but, you know.
Yeah, that whole adage of like, oh, wow, that's a really great photograph. You know, what kind of camera do you use? And it's like, well, you know, actually, it's a really great photograph because I have 45 years of photography experience. And, you know, I happen to shoot with the thing that's with me. It's... You know, again, it's the person who's manning the equipment that is ultimately creating, but it's the tool that they choose which allows them to manifest the idea in their head.
Yeah, and that said, I mean, you know, you like I was seeing, you know, Stu was waxing nostalgic about an older camera, fewer pixels, but it was a big sensor and it got so much light and all those pixels were nice and I think he called them creamy, you know. But so, you know, it says some things about that, though, you know, we're tearing down these things. But, you know, really, tools are tools. The great thing about this, though, is how these tools are landing in the hands of people. Yeah. It is democratizing, and I know a lot of people don't like that, but, you know, it's the way it is. And also for people who are pros, I mean, you're getting a better piece of equipment or a piece of equipment that is cheap now and better than the thing that was the greatest thing 10 years ago. And that's just amazing.
Yeah. I mean, remember when, you know, back in the day in the SD days, you know, you had the GL1 and the XL1 and all that. Yeah.
Right.
And they were, you know, we thought they were fantastic cameras, and they were for back in the day.
They were.
You know, they were really fantastic. You know, these DV cameras that were finally these big frame sensors, the three CCDs and
they
all
just
that.
Sucked in like nobody's business. And so they looked great.
And now we've got cameras that, I mean, the iPhone 4S has probably a larger, well, I shouldn't say that, but the quality coming out of the iPhone 4S probably better than anything you could possibly get out of an XL1. You know, not just because it's HD versus SD, but just the lens quality, the imaging quality, all that stuff. Again, that total package is just better, you know, because it's, what, 15 years, 20? Oh, my God, 20 years?
Oh, right, and then we have... Well, I mean, we have better tools to process those images, you know, because, you know, let's not forget, a lot of what happens to your images is in the processing, even if it's just in the capturing of it or things like that.
Right. You know, the processing is done in hardware on the camera itself. For example, in the 5D Mark III, we've got the new DJIC 5 Plus processor, which is doing so much work behind the scenes to make sure your image is awesome.
Right.
And that just didn't exist. The DJIC 4, for example, was also a very capable chip, and it did a lot of that as well. But the ability is just so radically better as to make the 4 look silly, really.
Right. And then you've got things like Premiere Pro, AE, Final Cut Pro, even Avid. They're starting to really kind of calm down. In actuality, the audience we're talking to are not high-end pros. You know, we're not talking to feature film.
Right, a lot of them are indies or DIYers and such.
Right.
And that's, you know, all this stuff is now in their hands, which they never had access to. Or maybe they were able to know someone who knows someone who's able to rent it to them kind of on the cheap or what have you. But, you know, they never had that ability. And now it's so available.
Or at least this level of it, yeah.
Right.
Because it's like we had the DV revolution, you know, and where all these things were coming into the hands of people. But those tools, they required so much push. You had to get behind the cart a lot to push. Now, whereas now the cart's got a nice motor in it, you know.
Yeah, now everything's available. You know, your average computer that you can buy today will certainly edit 1080p video. You know, you can buy a giant monitor so you can see that 1080p video and your interface without requiring multiple monitors. All that stuff is available. It's really, really amazing. You know, we've got all this new gear, and it's got all these weird new file formats, and you know, we've got AVCHD and we've got H.264 and all these different codecs. And well, now that people are shooting with all these disparate cameras, getting all that footage into your editing station becomes much more complex. You know, a lot of the NLE folks, Premiere Pro, Final Cut, Avid Media Composer, they really are stepping up their game and saying, hey, you know what? We're listening. We realize that you guys are shooting on weird hardware now, or what was weird hardware. You know, because back in the day, it used to be like, oh, everyone's shooting on P2 cards and everyone's shooting this type of thing. You know, back in the day, everyone had Betacam SP. Everything was tossed around on D1 tapes, you know, and so there was basically a single standard. And now there are a bunch of different standards with a bunch of different bit rates. And because budgets are so low and time is so tight, you know, you really need to have your edit station be able to take these disparate codecs and just plop it all in there in one giant soup and just start editing. And, you know, they're starting to do that now, which is really fantastic.
Yeah, because there's no excuse, really. There's money on the table, like you say.
Yeah. So. You know, for example, 5 years ago or so, Premiere Pro would have been laughed at as, oh, you use Premiere Pro to do NLE? That's not Pro. That's not something that real editors would ever use. And now they've listened. They've stepped up their game. They've got this fantastic Mercury playback engine. So if you've got an NVIDIA card, you know, everything is smooth as silk. Everything flies with no rendering, really. It's absolutely amazing. You drop your footage directly from your camera into the thing, and it's there. There's no transcoding unless you want to. You know, always have that option.
It's especially helpful for people shooting AVCHD. I mean, you're used to all the problems that come along with it and all the power it takes to transcode and whatnot. Yeah, you drop it in there and you can like play and edit directly. That's just amazing.
It's absolutely fantastic. And again, you know, that doesn't necessarily work for all environments, but if you can even the ability to, instead of transcoding, just merely copy your AVCHD onto the hard drive and dump it in there, and then have someone else transcode a different copy, so that then you can relink when you're going to go through a bunch of different editors because you've got 30 people working on it, which almost never happens anymore. But you know, if you do have some large number of people in the pipeline, you kind of want to standardize just so you can manage everything, so you don't have to worry about anything. Time is still of the essence, so having that flexibility of immediately being able to edit with the native codecs that come out of the camera as they're coming off the card, plus the backup ability to move it all to, say, ProRes or DNX HD is pretty fucking cool.
Yeah, I mean, because for a lot of people, including me, the workflow used to be is like the first thing you have to do is transcode the footage off the camera.
Yeah, and then the next day, you start editing. You know, you start
to drop that whole thing is a huge time. You know, it was a time waster, but it's great.
It's absolutely amazing. Now everything's just file copy. It's great.
Yeah, and again, Premiere Pro may still not be, you know, for
all purposes,
but you know, for the people that we're talking about here, it in many ways is ideal, along with Final Cut.
Yeah,
and even I think, you know, we haven't discussed this, but I think you and I would probably agree that there seems to be hints that Avid is starting to get on board with this whole, you know.
Well, they are
lower end.
It's kind of amazing. I mean, they clearly saw the Final Cut Pro 10. Announcement debacle, disaster, whatever you want to call it.
So when they offered that special package,
like $1,000. Yeah, $1,000, cross grade, done. Wow. You know, something that used to cost $1 jillion and require $8 bajillion worth of hardware investment, you know, is now $1,000, you know, without the requirement of a dongle. And that's really amazing, you know, because Avid's always been very slow to adopt stuff. part of that is stability. Avid has always been the king of the hill when it comes to, you know, multi-million dollar cinema.
No one else was on that hill.
It realized that it had a very, very small group of what is basically a captive audience. And so they could charge whatever the hell they wanted because their audience was so small. They kind of had to because, you know, they had to deal with all the R&D budgets and a lot of their hardware. They basically spec'd their own hardware. So, you know, that's a huge R&D sink. And if you only have 2,000 buyers, certainly under 50,000 people have purchased Avid systems, you know?
Right, because most of those people were not buying them themselves. They were, you know, someone else was buying them, and then you would go rent or lease time or book time.
Exactly.
You weren't buying your own Avid in most cases for the longest time.
You'd buy time at an Edit Bay or what have you. Or if you were a large company or so, you would use one of their edit bays.
Right.
You know, but it isn't something that you personally own. It's just, completely out of whack for that.
Yeah, it wasn't like, okay, there's 4,000 directors, therefore there's 4,000 Avids. It's like, no.
No.
smaller number.
And so in order to keep a company afloat, you obviously have to charge accordingly and also realize that Hollywood has gigantic budgets and so therefore you're going to want a piece of that. You're paying for that stability. You're paying for that R&D effort. Now that they're going to, I don't want to say the low end, but they're certainly seeing a market opportunity where they can increase their seats, they can increase their audience without diverging too much from what makes them the best in their category.
Right.
Which is
there's
fantastic.
More people wanting to buy, because now it's mostly about the software. You know, it's not so much about the hardware anymore because the individual is buying the hardware that they need and they don't really require as much specialized hardware anymore. So it's mostly about the Avid software. And so that's, you know, it. And then when you say, well, there is this audience out there, we could sell it to them as well. You know, that becomes really kind of a compelling argument for it. My prediction really is that this time next year, I think we'll see more affordable, either if not, you know, the full media composer, at least some other version of it for that market. And I think that would be amazing. I would be one of those people that would really take stock of things and go, well, maybe I ought to go back to Avid.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. You know, it suddenly becomes a viable option. They saw a time to strike and they saw a market opportunity which said, okay, we're going to target the people who have been upset by the Final Cut Pro 7, Final Cut Pro 10 transition, and we now are going to make it affordable for a whole new audience of people. And the neat part about that is that that gets people running Avid on their own desktops, which means that the kids coming out of school are going to be learning Avid, and that's going to be the NLE that they're used to, which means that, you know, they're going to want to use it when they start doing real work.
Yeah, not only that, these are more mouths talking about Avid.
Right.
And they're mouths that if they're your peers, you start to think, well, maybe I need to look in that as well, you know. Whereas it would have been someone who was running Final Cut Pro and you were running Final Cut Pro and you were in this sort of market, and then suddenly that person is now using Avid and you're like, well, maybe I should look into this. So,
yeah. It's pretty compelling.
Yeah, not to mention they had their new iPad app too. So that was a complete shock to me when that came out.
Oh, that looks fantastic, except that I have an iPad 1 and it's only iPad 2.
Yeah, I have an iPad 1 as well, but I pretty much think I'm ready for the upgrade when the new one comes out, so, which will be great.
No, this year my Amex card is going to just be wrecked. Absolutely wrecked. Oh, it's going to be dreadful. You know, new camera, new iPad. Yeah, and probably late this year, the iPhone 5 as well. So, yeah, my Amex card is going to be blown apart. Ugh.
I'll be looking for a 5D Mark II bodies.
Well, I was going to say, you know, because they lower the price on the 5D Mark II officially, and I imagine there's going to be a lot of people dumping their 5D Mark IIs on eBay. I'm actually keeping my 5D Mark II because that allows me to have a two-camera shoot.
Yeah,
you know,
with a good camera.
Exactly. It's still a fantastic camera. It still does everything I want it to do, you know, within its limitations. So I know that I can now have more coverage. Because all this stuff is more accessible, it just raises the bar. You know, it means that people who are DIYers like me can go in and for a reasonable amount of money create a much, much better production than we could even think about, you know, five years ago or 3 years ago even.
Yeah, in all fairness, it's raising the bar and lowering the barrier of entry.
Yeah.
But simultaneously, which is just a wonderful thing.
Which
I
is
love
fantastic.
The future.
Living in the future. it really is amazing. You know, because and a lot of people, I think a lot of established people, you know, sometimes they look down upon this lowering of the barrier of entry with disdain. And you know what? They were new at it one time too. And yeah, they had to go through the hazing rituals, sure. But you know what though? That time has passed. And
well, you know, not everyone wants to be where they are.
Yeah.
If you're a documentary producer doing stuff for a small cable channel, you know, you're not going to do what these guys, you know.
Yeah, you don't necessarily have, I mean, you may certainly, but you don't necessarily have aspirations of being a Hollywood producer or a DP. You know, it's just not what your, it's not your niche.
But you still need the tools, you know,
yeah.
And you still need the tools in the back end that do some of many of the same things and to the same level, you know, and it's just good for everybody. Yeah, it produces a lot of crap too, but don't watch the crap.
Yeah.
You know, you look at somebody, again, I keep going back to like indie or doco producers, but if you are a documentarian who does large scale, you know, documentary work, and but you have a small team, if you're saying, well, I'm going to spend $4,000 and rent this Ari, you know, to go do their next documentary, stop, go buy outright a C300 now. And
or two.
have a better camera than you would have been renting.
Right. Yeah.
That's just amazing.
Yeah, it's really pretty impressive. Young filmmakers or people who are trying to get into it, you know, don't look at the crap. Look at the best and then figure out how they did that and then do it yourself. The first several jillion times, it's gonna be awful. But eventually you'll get it right. You just have to persevere and you just have to keep doing it and keep getting better at it. Always raise your bar. I lift heavy things over my head as a recreational activity. And one of the things you do when weightlifting is you always want to slightly increase your weights every time you go to the gym, because that gets your muscles working properly. And it's the same thing. You know, you want to, every time you go and execute a project, you want to make it better in some way, shape or form than your last project. And if you keep doing that, one day you wake up and you may feel like you're a bit of a fraud because all these people are asking you to do these really amazing things. But the reality is that, no, you've worked for that. You've put in your blood, sweat, and tears. You are there. You are at that space.
Exactly. You know, and if you're someone who's, you know, already in that space or, you know, or even higher, don't just slight someone because you think, oh, you're some sort of, you know, amateur thing, whatever. Don't slight someone just because of that, because there are many jobs out there that you have no intention of doing and someone else does have an intention of doing just because they exist in the same sort of thing. You know, I came at this bass backwards. I am not a filmmaker, but I'm a technologist, computer specialist who came at video secondhand and became very interested in the technology behind it. So most of what I focus on is, you know, is the things that make these things. And then I also, because I'm having to do some of it, you know, does that make me an amateur? Absolutely. But I'm also a professional at something else that involves this. You know, so like there are very, very many spaces for people and there are very many different jobs. And the democratization of it all benefits everyone. So no whining.
On the flip side of that, if you are, you know, at the top of your game and you are seeing these young Turks come up, don't slack off. You've got to get better too, you know, because
exactly,
they will eat,
you know,
your lunch. They will totally eat your lunch. And they deserve to eat your lunch if you are not trying to up your own game.
Right. If you're dissing them because you like that barrier of entry being too high because you're already over it, then, well, screw you.
Well, then you have to do something to raise your barrier. So
yeah, and if you're not willing to do that, I don't want to hear your bitching.
If you're going to just rest on your laurels and not try to make your own game better, then, quite frankly, you're not very good.
Game over, man.
Game over. Game over. So I guess that about does it for another episode of Ruining It For Everyone. Maggie, where can we find you?
You can find me at about.me/MaggieMcPhee or on Twitter at TANKGRRL. And where can we find you, sir?
You can find me at Octothorpe on the Twitters. And you can find me at ruiningitforeveryone.tv. That was another episode of Ruining It For Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod. You can find us at ruiningitforeveryone.tv or search for Ruining It For Everyone on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe and rate the show as it really helps us out. Yeah.
I'm sitting here holding mine. In the
petting it, telling it that you love it. Yes.